counsel.
We had here a case wherein it's a credibility contest. Two people, no witnesses, present at the time, male, female, at home in their private home. The first issue that we raise before the court and that we raise before the ICA is the failure to allow the 404B evidence to come in. If you recall, the defense counsel appeared bringing in evidence of a prior incident that had happened 2 weeks earlier wherein the complainant had physically accosted the defendant. The court at that time ruled that that was not to be admitted because Lotus was too late. The ICA supported that decision, and the ICA based it on their reading of the federal rule 404B and termed it a condition precedent. That is, that the notice wasn't sufficient. It was untimely was the word that the ICA actually used. The problem with the ICA's analysis on this issue is this. The ICA goes to the federal rule 404B, which is directed at prosecution. That's directed at the prosecutor. 404B talks only about, FRE 404B talks only about a prosecutor's responsibility for giving notice of any bad acts they're going to use as far as a defendant. The ICA goes further in supporting that view by looking only to cases from other jurisdictions, both federal and state jurisdictions, whose 404B rule mirrors the FRE, again saying that they have to give notice and holding responsibility of the prosecution to be sure that a defendant has a sufficient notice. That's a different concern. It's an important concern, but it's a different concern than what we're going to talk about here today. That's a concern about due process for a defendant and a defendant being fully able to protect himself in trial, being fully able to have advised counsel and to present his defense. What happens under HRE, which is different than this, the FRE, HRE has a kind of parity. Defendants, as well as the prosecution, have to give notice of bad acts. The rule, 404B, calls for notice, and just like the trial court says, before trial, at trial, during trial. Any of those times, notice can be given. What happened here is the lawyer shows up, he's ready for trial, he's got his motions in limine, and he tells the court, now we've got this prior conduct, happened about 2 weeks ago. Lengthy discussion about why he hadn't given them notice prior, he explains. I only got the specifics this morning. As soon as I have it, I give it over to the court and I give it to opposing counsel. So he's doing all that he can to provide this information. The court's ruling is that it is untimely, despite the trial court saying, that it goes to the very crux of the defense. Self-defense case, prior evidence of violence on the part of the CW, first aggressor type evidence, which is of course going to be crucial in the examination of the evidence to be presented. When the Intermediate Court of Appeals goes to and plucks this language out of the FRE 404B that says notice is a condition precedent and uses that phrase, they highlighted in their decision, uses that phrase as a kind of talisman as though that discussion is over. Condition precedent is that there had to be notice. It's not sufficient notice, therefore that's the end of the analysis. That's where they go awry. The problem is this. They need to have notice. The other side needs to have notice. But you cannot just analyze the rules and not go to the constitutional consideration. The constitutional consideration is that the defendant has the right to present a defense, and he has the right to confront his witnesses. He has the right to...
Are the words condition precedent expressly in the federal rule?
Expressly in the federal rule?
Yes.
Yes.
But not in the state rule?
Not in the state rule.
What's the purpose of the requirement that all parties give notice?
On the most initial level is that so that everyone knows there's not at trial by ambush, so that admissibility issues can be decided early enough, and so that trials can proceed in an efficient manner. And so that the sort of pragmatic matters are those. And those are important matters. And what you see here in this trial court is the trial court is very concerned about what he says are the 60 jurors waiting outside. Those are important matters, but they're not matters that can rise to the level of trumping the defendant's constitutional rights. And that's where we get in trouble here.
Like discovery?
Like discovery?
Is it like discovery?
it's along the same lines of discovery in the Rule 16. And it's also analogous to Rule 16 and those HRPP Rule 16s and the idea of that you have to turn over discovery, and if you don't get discovery in a sufficient amount of time.
Does Rule 16 or any other discovery rule, or did any party argue that there was, outside of 404B, an obligation to make known to the court and the prosecution that the defense might cross-examine on the complainant's use of marijuana?
There was not any discussion of that prior to it coming up in testimony. And the reason for that, it appears from the record, is that that was not viewed as 404B evidence by defense, and that would be the correct interpretation of that.
Is that HRPP 16 evidence?
No, not even so. Because what that really goes to is the quality of this witness as a percipient witness. Were they intoxicated, and Sabag examines that? Were they intoxicated? Were they, their perceptions impaired in any way, their recollection impaired in any way by virtue of use of alcohol and or drugs? So we don't believe that even to be a 404B issue, although that is how it was kept out in this case. We'll go back to the point now about the HRE, how the HRE differs from FRE in this sense. What happens is whenever they wave this flag sort of a condition precedent and say that, okay, it's a condition precedent, you didn't hit the notice quickly enough, therefore that's the end of the analysis. The court fails to go the next step because there's another step in the framework of the analysis. For the FRE, all they're talking about is what the prosecution has to do. It looks like what the ICA tried to do was just a kind of mirror image, just flip that over without going to the next step of doing what had to happen is, okay, if the condition precedent is you had to give notice, then what do you look at? You look at the analysis of the defendant's constitutional rights to confront witnesses, to present a defense under his due process rights, and to have a full and fair cross-examination. Without doing that analysis, without going to 402, 401, obviously this is evidence that would have been relevant, without going to 402 and the 403 prejudice versus probative analysis, the trial court just stops and says it's not timely enough. Without ever even going to the prosecution saying, okay, how would this prejudice you? There's no proof, no indication that the state actually is prejudiced. The state says, I'm ready. I object to the evidence, I'm ready. So there's no examination of the prejudice that the state would have felt. And in fact, there would have been no prejudice to the state. What would have been eminently practical here for a court, and what many trial courts do all the time, is they could have gone ahead and picked their jury. I mean, we understand the court's concern about moving on and picking the jury. They could have gone right ahead and picked their jury. At the end of motions in limine, at the end of jury selection, so that those folks didn't have to wait, they started evidence. In this case, it appears from the minutes, which are not part of the record of appeal, but they are contained here. It looks as though they started the opening statements at 3:05 in the afternoon.
Well, technically, the issue was brought to the court's attention within the parameters of the rule.
Absolutely.
Because the rule says prior to trial.
Prior to trial.
And this was prior to what, voir dire?
That's correct, first thing in the morning.
The rule doesn't set out any time limit, does it?
No, and in fact, the rule even says it can be brought up during trial.
Well, with good cause.
That's right. In this instance, if there was genuinely a concern about prejudice, and I got to say, without having made the, without examining whether or not there was prejudice, the trial court has failed. That's to some extent the end of that discussion. If they don't even look to see if there's prejudice, then the trial court has failed. And the ICA has furthered that failure by not saying, okay, what was the prejudice? Had the trial court been concerned of what the trial court could have done, pick that jury, tell them to come back first thing in the morning, spend that afternoon, because you notice in this case prosecution has two prosecutors. One prosecutor could have talked to that witness. They've got the proposed witness, proposed evidence. The prosecutor could have talked to that witness. They could have found out if they had a problem. Then had they indeed needed to continue, there could have been a continuance. At the point that they terminated this, at the point that they denied the defendant his opportunity to use this evidence, they had never even found out if there was any prejudice. They cut this crucial evidence off without even doing the examination that they needed to do.
Case law where in this jurisdiction an appellate court or appellate courts have said there was an abuse of discretion when a continuance was not granted in the circumstances where the defendant either was aware of new evidence or wanted to, well, was aware of new evidence that arose during the trial.
There is case law to that effect. That when you bring it forward and you're not allowed to be given a continuance, then yes, that's not permissible. But I guess, again, I want to kind of reinforce the idea that this could have been dealt with without an extended continuance. And you'll notice in the record that the prosecutor begins to ask for a continuance and then backs off of that. And when the judge says, then she says, no, I want to go forward. Because she's the person who would have perhaps needed the continuance to be sure that she had full disclosure of what she needed for the evidence.
The purpose of the notice requirement is focus on 404B, the prior acts in regards to character and propensity.
Well, prior acts in this instance, right, for this individual as having had acts of aggression in the past towards this defendant.
The cross-examination of the marijuana or whatever, the prior act of smoking marijuana, and was that part of it?
I'm not sure I understand. Was that
was the evidence of marijuana use, did it come under this particular objection? They held it inadmissible.
They were actually treated differently because in the beginning that day, the beginning of trial, before trial started, whenever defense comes forward with its 404B evidence about the prior aggression, there's no mention of the marijuana at that point. The marijuana only comes up later in testimony whenever defense counsel attempts to ask the complainant about it.
That had nothing to do with the 404B.
It was objected to on 404B grounds, and it was kept out on 404B grounds, but that was incorrect, and it had not been presented to the court earlier as 404B.
Okay, but was that part of the holding that the evidence regarding marijuana was inadmissible was not based upon no notice?
That's correct. That business comes out of this earlier act of aggression.
No notice meaning what, 404B?
Correct.
So are you saying the trial court excluded cross-examination on marijuana use by under 404B?
The trial court did exclude. That's correct. Now, what the trial court did permit, which is not sufficient, but the trial court did permit the defendant to be asked if he smelt anything, and he said he smelt marijuana. But allowing a defendant to answer one question on direct is certainly not the same thing as being allowed to explore something on cross-examination.
Did the ICA affirm the court on 404B grounds?
The ICA did.
The ICA, I'm sorry. Does 404B apply?
Again, don't believe so. Because I don't believe that was...
Why not?
Because that was not about a prior bad act. What that was about is, of course it was at the time, but what that was about is the witness as a percipient witness. And again, I'd go back to Sabat. This is a person who's having this experience, who the counsel has a good faith basis for asking, were you impaired in any way? Had you smoked marijuana that day? Had you had anything to drink? How much had you had anything to drink? Have you been around marijuana before? Are you familiar with the result?
So evidence went in about drinking, though.
There was a question asked.
Okay.
I guess a fair response is there was testimony on direct of the defense that there was a bottle there that he had not seen earlier, and the complainant was asked if she had had anything to drink.
Ms. Marshall, was there also evidence that the complainant in this case smacked the defendant?
Well, no, because it was stricken. And because of the ruling, the 404B ruling early on, and they were not allowed to get into that, when direct examination of the defendant is talking about this prior incident when they were arguing, and this was about the dog, he says, and then she smacked him. Immediate objection, sustained, they went to the bench, that is true. So that was out. The reason that it's keenly important here, I'm not going to say more important than in another case, but the reason it's keenly important here is because it's self-defense. and because the evidence of prior aggression makes all the difference in the world in explaining the defendant's conduct. Because he's already had an experience with this woman, or at least he has the right to put that before the jury and let the jury weigh that. Because he's already had this experience with this woman where she's been physically aggressive towards him, his perception of what is going to happen, which is what ties into the jury instruction error here, his perception of what's going to happen in this circumstance is based on his prior experience of her. And when you look at the physical evidence in this case, the evidence that there are bruises on her arms, utterly consistent with someone trying to restrain someone who's coming at him because he's been down this road before and he knows how this is going to go. What's particularly interesting, I guess, to me in a way, is how the errors in this case all undergird one another and make it more egregious than it is. You've got this evidence that should have been allowed. Sufficient notice, no indication of any prejudice to the state. So this evidence of this prior contact should have been allowed. It's not allowed. Then you get this jury instruction that's incorrect, that doesn't talk about the component of how it has to be the defendant, a reasonable person in the circumstances that the defendant is in.
Does 404B require a showing of prejudice on behalf of the person opposing the introduction of the evidence?
Yeah. Once you've got the 404, they challenge it.
The rule requires prejudice.
Yes, it's not timely notice. Then what should have happened is there should have been a transition back. They should have had to prove why are they disadvantaged.
Oh, okay. So the rule 404B requires showing of prejudice.
Otherwise, why would you not let it in? I mean, I'm sorry. There would be a whole discussion of it's 401, is it relevant? 402, mm-hmm. for what purposes? Then 403 analysis, a more prejudicial right. approach is probative. But to merely say it didn't get to me in time, that's not sufficient.
Well, that issue goes through the continuance, doesn't it?
It does.
More than 404B.
Well, it's not clear if anyone needed a continuance. The state doesn't want a continuance. What the state seems to want, the defense asked for a continuance. The state say they don't want a continuance, but perhaps strategically they think it's better for them to just not even have the evidence. We can keep the evidence out. But that's not the proper thing to have done for the court. And
the question of whether or not there was prejudice to the prosecution goes to whether the court should or should not have given a continuance.
That's right.
Prejudice either way.
That's right. Because when the defense asks for a continuance, the defense is doing that to allow the prosecution to do whatever it is they need to do. And if they had gone and talked to their witness and the witness had said, no, not only did we not have a fight on that day, I was in Wyoming on that day, then that would have all been relevant. But because they never go that far, they just limit the defense of constitutional rights. They don't proceed how they need to. I'm sorry, Justice Nakayama, did I answer your question?
Well, I just don't see in 404B a requirement of showing a prejudice. I agree with Justice Acoba that it's more of a continuance analysis, but my reading of 404B doesn't seem to require a showing.
Well, maybe I'm not stating it clearly enough, and I apologize for that. When you look at that chapter, the 400 chapter, if you're going to oppose evidence,
I understand your argument.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go back to the instruction matter then. When they don't allow, when there's an improper instruction given, the court's responsibility, and when there's an improper instruction given on the self-defense justification, such that it leaves out a person in the defendant's, a reasonable person standing in the defendant's circumstances, that exacerbates this business about why he wasn't permitted to provide information, testimony, evidence about the previous attack by the woman. Without that instruction and without that evidence, it becomes much closer to being a case of where 200-pound man, 100-pound woman, he's beating her up. But had the court given the proper instruction where they talk about it's an individual, reasonable person in the circumstances as this defendant knows, and what this defendant knows and what could have been argued then is he knows this woman, he knows that this has happened in the past, he knows that he needs to calm her down, he needs to restrain her in some way. They're not permitted to do anything of that because there's an effect of all of that instruction missing. And he's denied the fairness of the trial. Without the evidence and then with the improper instruction, he's sort of double-barreled in this instance.
On the marijuana use,
yes.
Sabag says that evidence of marijuana use can come in if the use is at or near the time of the incident.
That's correct.
Was it at or near the time of the incident?
That was, yes.
That's why the 404B notice requirement doesn't apply.
That's correct, because the testimony of the defendant in this case is that when he came in, he smelled marijuana. And then, of course, they were not able to ask the witness about this. The thing that's, because, you know, the confrontation provides sort of two, you're going for two things there. It's the engine of truth through doing this inquiry, and you're asking questions and all that, and you're trying to get answers, and you're testing the testimony against the responses under interrogation. But you're also giving the jury the opportunity to observe this witness, to weigh their demeanor. That's part of confrontation. So if they had been allowed to have this series of questions, to go through this, they could weigh this woman. Evidence. They could see if they found her credible. Had they, you'll notice in the testimony as it is, we have a somewhat floating story. At some point, she says that he knocked her into something. At another point, she says, "Oh, she thinks she fell over that little pedestal by the bed." So you see cross examination working in the case in the transcript as it should have, but by not giving the jury the opportunity to see her about the marijuana, just allowing the defendant to say, "I smelled marijuana," is not sufficient. That doesn't protect what should have been his constitutional rights to confrontation and due process. Of course, again, the same thing on the prior bad act, the prior act of aggression. On the issue about the instruction, the kind of erroneous instruction under Aganon, well, the ICA kind
of... the language of the instruction, why isn't that sufficient? It says, the defendant reasonably believes... Yeah, the part you say is missing. The instruction says a person employing protective force may estimate the necessity thereof under the circumstances as he reasonably believes them to be. Is that sufficient to bring in the so-called subjective element that the... juries to consider the circumstances as the defendant knew them or reasonably should have known them?
No.
Why not?
Well, we could go to Pemberton, but the reason that it's not is because that would be just the reasonable person standard, not factoring in this person, this circumstance. And that goes so far as if a defendant is mentally handicapped, if a defendant has some sort of prior experiences, particularly if a defendant is much larger, much bigger, all of those things get to be considered. And when that's not laid out here, it's entirely possible that a juror could think, well, it's never going to be reasonable for a man to have to use some sort of force against a woman. So a reasonable man might never use force against a woman. So without that, as you say, that subjective prong, where that gets to be laid out for a juror, which is this person behaving reasonably in this circumstance, to merely say a reasonable person is not sufficient. It stunts what's supposed to be happening in terms of evaluating the evidence.
Isn't the term circumstances enough?
No. I don't think so. No.
Did the instruction track the statute?
Because it leaves that section out about when you go to Pemberton and it requires that, and then when you go to Hodgick, again, I recognize that Hodgick is not the standard, but it takes that statement in there, subjective standard in there.
Did the instruction instruct the jury that the defendant employs protective force, may estimate the necessity thereof under the circumstances as he reasonably perceives them to be? Was that the instruction that was given?
That's right.
How does that not comply with the statute?
Well, because what should have been included is the reasonableness of the defendant's belief that the use of the force was immediately necessary shall be determined from the viewpoint of a reasonable person in the defendant's position under the circumstances of which he was aware or reasonably believes. The difference is that characterizes it to this defendant in these circumstances of his awareness or what he can be aware of. The other's a much more limited standard. This merely under the circumstances as he believes them to be.
As he reasonably believes them to be.
Yeah, as he reasonably, but that's an insufficient statement of what needs to have happened here. On the issue of the Agonon instruction, and when we turn to that instruction, where those two, and the state conceded at the ICA, and the ICA agreed that it had been, that that was wrong, that that instruction was conflated, but they believe that they overcame that, that it wasn't sufficient to be overturned. That's a misapplication of Agonon. It's a way of saying, yes, we know it's an error, but we think it'll be okay because the jury didn't send us a communication that there was anything wrong with it in the way that they did in Agonon. It's not clear. And in this case, it's particularly problematic because a juror could have found that he was had used self-defense, but that he was reckless in doing so, an imperfect self-defense. He was reckless in doing so, but he did not know there had been a crime. Because of his recklessness, he did not know there had been a crime, which would have been what was required in the interference charge. So by conflating the conduct and attendant circumstances, it makes it all the more likely that there's going to be an improper verdict because of this possibility of the imperfect self-defense. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. Richard Minatoya, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, County of Maui for the state. In response to the issues that the appellant raises regarding the confrontation issue, you know, this is not unlike Hawaii Rules of Evidence Rule 412 situation where there's And Chief Justice Moon wrote the opinion in State versus West that there was a threshold to go through before you could introduce that type of evidence. And in West, it involved an allegation of a false allegation of sexual assault made by a complaining witness. In this case, all they had to do was provide notice prior to trial, unless, of course, there's just cause for not doing so. In this case, this would allow the defense to basically sandbag raising the self-defense issue, surprising the prosecution with this allegation that there was some prior incident between the complaining witness and the defendant, and thereby not leaving the prosecution with enough time to investigate the validity of that allegation. In this case, it's the morning of trial. Hey, look, on this date, this thing happened. I mean, where was the opportunity for the prosecution to investigate, or where would that opportunity be? And the court made it clear. The court says, "Hey, look, this was the prominence of the case, the prominence of the defense case, basically saying, you know, there's this alleged self-defense, and they don't provide the notice. They knew it was there." And on the day of trial, when trial's about to commence, that happens.
Mr. Minatoya, what is your response to Ms. Marshall's argument that the court could have impaneled the jury and then continued the case?
Well, the question would have been, then there's some speculation on how long it would take, and I think there's a question of judicial economy as far as that's concerned. Even with the marijuana use, the defense did have the opportunity to have the defendant testify that he did smell marijuana. There's no allegation that the marijuana smell, or there's no facts to show that the marijuana smell came from the complaining witness. In Sabog,
the defense's position, right?
Well,
that's why they needed to cross-examine.
Well, in Sabog, there's actual testimony of the complainant who says, "You know, I'm an addict, and I was coming down off of the use." In this case, you know, there's just an allegation that I smelled marijuana, and
well,
at that point
that's all the defense was allowed to ask.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, except the fact that, you know, Then they become in a position where they're just speculating as to who used the marijuana and that it was her. Right?
Well,
so basically,
ready to testify? Excuse me. Wasn't he ready to testify that she used marijuana?
I believe it was she had used marijuana before. Now, the thing is, then it still becomes a 404B issue at that time because it is, number one, a bad act prior to when this incident occurred. But I think also it puts her in a position where she has to testify about potentially doing an illegal act. And I think that's, you know, under oath on top of that, I think that's another problem.
Well, that wasn't... Sabag doesn't say that's a problem.
That's correct. But in practical matters, and I think also, you know, as far as...
We never even got that far, though, so we don't know what would happen.
That's correct, because the court was able... Well, the court limited limited that situation to avoid that problem.
Well, it also eliminated the right to
in result of
on that issue, right?
That's correct. And but, you know, as far as you know, attorneys in general can't ask questions on a fishing expedition, you know, with the result of embarrassing a witness, etc. In this case, you know, there's just a smell, nothing about the cause of the smell, but then putting the complaining witness in the position of having to testify under oath whether or not marijuana, she used marijuana. I think that's the distinction in this case.
Sir, did you say that there was prior evidence of prior use?
I believe there was an allegation that she used it in the past, and when he came home, he smelled the marijuana, allegedly, and they tried to make the link that it was her that used it. And, again...
Was there evidence that the room that they were in when he said, I smell marijuana, was a closed room?
I believe it was the bedroom. I mean, I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, he came home later. Whether she had another guest there or not, that hasn't been established. With respect to the self-defense issue, I think Justice Nakayama is correct. The instruction that was given, although not following Hajig, does track the statute. And it does talk about the defendant's or the person's reasonable belief that force was necessary. And in fact, we would argue, you know, the Hajik and the proposal that the defense raised talks about an awareness as well, in addition to reasonably believe. And I think an argument would be the awareness part was not included, it was just a reasonable belief. And based on that, it actually benefited the defense that there didn't have to be an actual awareness, just a reasonable belief for the self-defense issue to kick in.
You know, this court has said three times that that is an instruction that should be given or it represents the law. Said that in Estrada, said that in Pemberton, and said that in Augustine. And the commentary to the Hajik cites to Estrada, cites to Pemberton, and in Augustine, this court said that that instruction is fully consonant with the controlling statutory and case law of this state. So you have three Supreme Court opinions saying that is the instruction that should be given. Why wasn't it given?
I can't answer that. And, you know, I sit on the Hajik committee, and, you know, I always tell our deputies to follow Hajik because you got a whole bunch of people who've discussed it, you know, both prosecution and defense and judges.
Well, the reason those three decisions say, you know, that's the law, and the fact that it wasn't given in this case doesn't mean that there was error in this case then?
I think the ICA was correct when it held that it complied with Pemberton to the extent that it was not an objective standard, it was a subjective standard of being in the defendant's position. I think
Hodgick
also
says, well, the commentary to Hodgick says, you know, this represents a subjective application. The jury must consider the circumstances as the defendant subjectively believed them to be at the time of the defendant defended himself or herself. So that is supposed to, if you talk about reasonably believes, then we're talking more or less about an objective standard. But the instruction was intended to also incorporate a subjective viewpoint. So if you eliminate that subjective viewpoint, then isn't that contrary to what these three cases say?
Well, I think the bottom line is it puts it in the defendant's perspective. It doesn't talk about, as for example in Pemberton, that all facts that are in evidence, regardless whether he knew them or not, this is still reflecting upon what the defendant, you know, what's in the realm of what the defendant knows or reasonably believes.
Mr. Minatoya, who submitted the self-defense instruction that the court gave?
It appeared that it was something that was edited by the court.
Was there an objection to the self-defense instruction?
There was no objection.
Okay.
You recognize in your brief that doesn't make a difference.
That's correct. Which is why we also tell our deputies that the court is responsible, so you need to make sure, no matter what, if there is an objection on our part, that we make the objection. As far as the instruction regarding the interference with making the 911 call, you know, we do agree that the circumstances, attendant circumstances, and result of conduct elements were melded into one element, and although improper, it still left the jury, or had the jury make the determination, first of all, whether or not the person was the victim, and to get to the question of whether or not there was an interference, there was actual interference with the call. Therefore, the jury had to consider the three actual elements of the offense, although two of those elements were melded into one element. So basically, the net result was there was no prejudice to the defendant, and the instruction as given was harmless, because there was no effect to the analysis that the jury had to do.
Was there a violation of 404B when the defendant in fact gave notice of his proposed use of the prior assault before trial?
Well, the question is whether or not at the time it was given, when voir dire was about to take place, was before trial or not.
Well, the rule says before trial, and this is before any of the formal proceedings have started.
Again, I think the question would be whether that is before trial when the case is called. My understanding was done at the time, or just before jury selection took place that morning.
Okay. So there's no time limit or requirement on the rule?
Well, Rule 404B talks about reasonable notice in advance of trial. Reasonable, I guess, is some determination to be made by the court. In this case, the court found the morning of was not reasonable.
It uses the term reasonable.
It says in criminal cases, the proponent of evidence, not just the prosecution, as in the federal rule, of evidence to be offered under the subsection, shall provide reasonable notice in advance of trial.
Okay.
So there is.
You can also give notice during trial.
That's correct. On good cause shown.
Even if there might have been a violation of this notice requirement, wouldn't the right of confrontation override whatever violation there might have been?
I think it depends on the situation. I think in this case...
Are you familiar with the Pacetti case?
No, I'm not.
Okay. In Pacetti, the complainant of a sexual assault charge gave a statement to the counselor, sexual abuse counselor. And the Hawaii Revised Statute said that that statement was not discoverable because it was privileged. This court said the fact that it was privileged does not override the constitutional right of confrontation. And this court said, because of that constitutional right of confrontation, the defendant could discover and could examine the complainant on the statement made to the counselor, even though the Hawaii Revised Statute, Hawaii Rules of Evidence said that that statement was privileged. Wouldn't that control in this case?
Possibly.
Is this notice requirement something like discovery?
My argument is it would be. I think our argument, our position would be, you know, there's a procedure that you have to follow. If you don't follow the procedure, much like in the Rule 412 situation, you need to follow the procedure before you're able to present.
So wouldn't you give weightier... Wouldn't you weigh a privilege heavier than you would, say, a discovery requirement?
I think it's in the nature and quality of what is being proposed. I mean, if you know, there's no other witness to show that there was this actual... No, it's third-party witness to show that there was this actual prior alleged abuse by the complaining witness. I think if there was, depending on the quality of what is being proffered, I think that determination should be made. Because I think in this case, the problem is the fact that, you know, now the defense has the opportunity to sandbag the prosecution and try and cloud the issue.
Talking about sandbagging, but what is... This was a claim of a prior assault. There are only two people involved. Wouldn't a reasonable continuance have allowed the prosecution to prepare for that?
I think appellant's attorney's example is reflective of that. Counsel says, well, if the complaining witness says, I was in Wisconsin on that day, well, then we'd have to go and find out if she... was in Wisconsin or not, track down the tickets, track down the receipts for the tickets, or to show that, or the boarding passes to show that she
That's
was
fine.
In Wisconsin.
And if you adduce facts like that in the record, then we would say the court, we could say the court didn't abuse its discretion.
That's correct.
But here there's been no showing. All the prosecution said was you didn't follow the rule. Never said what problems there might be, or even made any attempt to determine what, if any, problems there would be.
That's correct. However, that wasn't proffered either. So, I think
doesn't the rule require a showing of good cause?
That's correct.
It's not a requirement of the person not presenting it to show why it's going to inconvenience that person, that party. It's a showing of good cause. And
that's
what was
correct.
The cause that was presented in this case?
In this case, it was the allegation that self-defense was used instance.
The good cause for the lateness.
I believe counsel was busy the week before and could not get the information and did not receive the actual date of what was occurred till that morning. I believe, was the only the only reason given to the court.
And the court found that didn't constitute good cause.
That's correct.
Good cause. Well, the court never made a finding of good or not good cause. He just said, "Well, I have 60 jurors waiting. I'm going to go ahead," but never looked at any of the merits of the issue.
Well, it does. The court does talk about, you know, quoting the court, if it goes to the heart of the defense, then it should have been given. It should have been something given more prominence earlier. I can believe that it's much to the heart of it based on the way it's dribbling in.
And the good cause requirement applies to a request made during the trial. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that good cause requirement doesn't relate to a request made
but
in advance of trial.
The showing of good cause has to be made by the proponent of the evidence.
The rule says the good cause requirement applies to requests made during trial.
That's correct.
As opposed to in advance of trial.
That's correct.
Okay. So, are you familiar with Estrada, where the court said this court said the court should have given a continuance where prosecution produce new material during the trial?
Well, in this case, and I'm anticipating your next question about why it doesn't apply to this case, you know, our position would be that, one, there was no request on the proponent side for a continuance as well. And I think also the judicial economy of having this case ready to go with the 60 jurors waiting, or 60 potential jurors waiting.
I may be incorrect, but I thought the defense did ask for a continuance.
I may be wrong too, but my understanding of what it was that they just wanted to go ahead and present or raise this issue, and we objected to it because of the fact or the ability to check and verify what was being proposed or proffered.
You never said that. The record doesn't reflect that, though.
It just shows that, my understanding, it just shows that we did object at the time it was proffered.
Mr. Minotauri, I think there was a request to continue trial. But it wasn't raised as a point of error on appeal.
Okay. It's then corrected. So, unless there are any further questions by the court, I believe that we have addressed the issues raised by the appellant, and thank you very much.
Just briefly, it is on page 4, 3, and 4 of the transcript where the defendant appellant did come in asking for a continuance in order to be sure that the state had plenty of access to the information. The state is who refused. That they said they didn't want a continuance. What they wanted was to just keep the evidence out, which was not a proper response to what the problem was. What's happening here is the 412 is not a bad example, and it's also similar to what's going on in Grace and the whole line of hearsay cases, which the rules of evidence are important, and they serve a function, and they certainly serve a function in terms of the orderly practice of a trial. But they cannot trump a defendant's constitutional rights. And that's what has happened here. There is a rule. The rule was largely complied with. There's no suggestion that defense counsel is operating in bad faith. There's no suggestion that defense counsel is sandbagging. The minute he got the information, he comes forward with it, he turns it over.
Ms. Marshall, so trial was scheduled to start at 8:30.
That's right.
Okay. What time was this evidence offered on the record to the court?
It appears to be the very first go on the record, and I can't talk about how what happened earlier, I mean, prior to
sure. What time did they go on the record?
8:46. Okay. They convened on the 27th.
Okay.
And then,
do you think, and at 8:40, this trial is scheduled to start at 8:30. I guess reasonable minds differ whether or not the trial has actually started yet, but the first thing on the calendar is the defendant brings up at 8:47 notice of intended defense.
It
is
looks like on about the 12th line of the transcript okay. They've begun that discussion.
Look at 404B does require reasonable notice.
That's right.
Okay, is that reasonable?
It is reasonable, and here's why. This is his earliest opportunity. Now, this is, of course, only on the record, so we don't know what they've discussed in the back, what he's told them in the hall, which is the utterly common practice that happens every day at court. But this is his first opportunity, and he explains, and he goes in great detail. He brought the information to me this morning. It appears that defense counsel actually is being a little fastidious. He appears to think that it has to be done in writing, and then he has to give the specific date.
If the right to confrontation trumps the rule, is the rule unconstitutional then?
No.
I mean, why have the rule if you can always bring it up at any time pursuant to constitutional rights?
Well, that's not a choice that has to be made with all respect, Your Honor. What that is the rule is the guideline, and the rule needs to be followed. But in an instance, and this is certainly not in every case, in an instance where defense counsel has this information, brings it immediately, is open and clear about it, and says this is what we need to do, then that's reasonable. He's doing all that he can. No one at that point has been disadvantaged. The state is not disadvantaged in any way. That is reasonable. And that's what he's done.
Was the defendant in custody?
Doesn't appear so, no. Looks like this is about a two-month-ish. Okay, no, it doesn't appear so. So, following the rules, but that cannot rise to the level of denying him this. And these are the kind of the most important constitutional rights for a defendant, the right to confront and the right for due process. And a kind of, without even an exploration of the difficulties that it might cause for either side, to just make this, I'm finding it's untimely, let's go, is not an, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, please finish your answer.
Just I'm say that. I think knee-jerk is too strong a word, but a kind of black-and-white adherence to the rules without an exploration of what the cost would be in terms of time, of other alternatives, and the fact that these are the defendant's constitutional rights, and even more so in this case, this is an incident of prior aggression in a self-defense case, a case where you've only got two people who are going to have any credibility.
How do you answer Mr. Minatoya's argument about marijuana use, that it was brought up too late, or I'm not exactly can't exactly remember what his arguments were. How do you answer his
argument? And I'm not sure that I'll recall it exactly either, and I apologize if I don't, but as I recall, the response was that they were speculating in a kind of fishing expedition about marijuana. That was not. There's a good faith basis. The defendant says he walked in and smelled it. So to come in and to ask the question and to be allowed to cross-examine the complainant, the person who is there in the place, and this is their residence, it appears. It's the lower story of a two apartment kind of building. So to come in and discuss that, again, perceptually.
So they were living together and he testified he smoked marijuana, so you say that's the basis for further cross-examination or cross-examination of the complainant on whether she was using marijuana at the time.
Well, of course, a cross-examination would have come further, but the good faith basis is his for asking the question, so that it's not a fishing expedition, so it's not just speculation, is that he comes in and he says that he smells marijuana. And then his opportunity to, what should have been his opportunity to explore that.
What about the objection that, well, you know, this might relate to a crime and she was under oath?
Well, two things. First of all, it wouldn't be treated as a crime. It would just, the question of whether or not you had smoked marijuana, not did you possess, not are you, just had you smoked marijuana such that you're, to examine her perception, that would never be treated as a crime. And that's really a red herring. That's a false argument. And I know that's where the court went. I know the trial court went there. But again, I think a kind of over-attention to trying to move things along. If, honestly, they were truly concerned about this, because it certainly comes up in trials where you're going to question somebody about gambling or whatever, standard practice, you stop the proceeding. The judge inquires of the witness, would you like counsel? There's a possibility that you could incriminate yourself. Think about it. The prosecution talks to the witness. They make a determination of whether or not they want to go forward. But again, there's an absolute remedy that doesn't require deprivation of constitutional rights. We're asking this court to overturn the Intermediate Court of Appeals, vacate the convictions, and remand this. Thank you for your attention.
Court will keep this matter under advisement.